him, you know, all right, well, let's do 800 volts and maybe 150, 175 mil. We know the instead of going to last 3 years, it's only going to last a year, because that catheter is going to die at a quick death as opposed to a slow death, that's all. And what does it mean for the manufacturer? Is this going to sell you another better tube?
If I put 800 volts on the plate instead of 650 or 700, is it the extra plate dissipation and the heat of the plate, is that what's going to kill the cathode earlier, Eric, to your knowledge, or is it that the higher temperature of the plate creates greater outgassing of contaminants into the vacuum? What's the mechanism of destruction if I over-dissipate the plate of that tube and I start making it glow red a little bit, you know, a slight dull glow red of the plate if I look at it in a dark room? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Actually, there's some broadcast tubes that are kind of designed to glow red. Well, the plate's made out of molybdenum, so it's a pretty inert metal, but at high temperatures, it does tend to combine with other materials like oxygen and nitrogen and that kind of stuff. So, you generally won't find it being alloyed. It doesn't have those good characteristics. If you've ever taken a tube apart, you know that plate material is sort of pliable, but it's also brittle. Alright? So really, there's a multitude of functions going on. One is the increased plate dissipation, which also means increased cathode current. They give you a rating of what the maximum distance between the heater with respect to the cathode with respect to the plate. So, you know, what's happening is you wind up making the cathode surface hotter, the thoriated material starts bubbling off of it, and you wind up having shorter life, because the emission begins to drop as you lose that material, and it actually winds up in the vacuum. It eventually gets collected by the getter, lines the walls of the tube. The overheating plate also bakes it on there real good, and eventually you get to the point where the cathode just can't give you too much emission. K2RIW, K2J.
Okay, I would certainly be shortening the life of the tube if I ran the filament voltage higher than normal. If I'm a really smart amateur, and I'm pushing the daylights out of the plate, 800 volts of some ridiculous number of milliamps, and I'm dissipating more current, and the plate is more power, and the plate is running a cherry red, if I lowered the filament voltage during that operation, would I be able to have my cake and eat it too? What do you think, Eric?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a good theory, and that's something that one of the guys tried to prove to me on a big TV transmitter. I kind of proved him wrong. It's a good theory, but you've got to consider that what you're doing is you're exciting this chemical material with the heat to emit electrons, right? And if you are able to draw, say, the 175 mils or the 200 mils of plate current, you know that you're getting an equivalent amount of emission at the cathode. If the cathode is a little bit cooler, you would think to be able to drive that many electrons off of that surface, something's got to be making it warmer, don't you think?
In the case of a 4CX250B tube run at full power output at 500 megacycles, there is a phenomenon called back bombardment of the cathode that takes place. Some of those electrons that during the positive half cycle of the RF voltage you put on the control grid accelerate some electrons that boil off the cathode. Not all of them get through the screen grid. Some of them come slamming back on the next half cycle and create extra cathode heating. And they do recommend lowering the 6.00 volts on the filament down to 5.5 when you're using key down service, 500 megs full power output. So in the case of the 4CX250B, by way of the recommendations of a number of the tube manufacturers, another very popular tube, by the way.
Don't forget, you got air blowing through that thing.
Good point. So what you're saying is that even though the dissipation is sky high, if you're moving enough air through it, the anode is still running at a reasonable temperature. All that's really happening is that you're slamming the electrons more rapidly at the higher voltage into the plate, into the anode, but you're still expecting near normal cathode emission. If I ask for excess cathode emission, if a tube is good for peak current during Class C service of, I'm going to pick a number, an ampere. And I do something like drive the daylights out of the control grid, raise the screen voltage sky high, raise the plate voltage sky high, load the plate very heavily, but resonate it. So now I'm asking for great big chunks of cathode current higher than the manufacturer recommended. Is there an easy way I could understand the mechanism of destruction of the cathode if I demand that service? If I got enough air going through it and I keep everything from getting accelerated in temperature, but I'm demanding excess cathode emission, does that create a destruction of the cathode material that shortens the life? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
All right, K2LIW, K2EJ. How can I answer this? I mean, if we talk about a triode that doesn't have a cathode, we don't run into any of these issues. And actually, when you're going to run something in a continuous duty service that's maximum dissipation, it's best to run the filament down to as low a voltage as possible where you still are able to have sufficient emission. That brings you lower temperatures if you're talking about a cathode. There is a range of operating temperature for the cathode. In a more complex tube, as you mentioned with the 4CX, there's a certain amount of depositing and redepositing, leaving and coming back. You know, we don't think of it, but it's a molecule-by-molecule basis. Over a period of time, it adds up to a heck of a lot of molecules. So, there is an interactive mechanism between filament voltage, filament cathode current, plate current, and plate voltage. There is a range in which it operates, but if you want the tube to last forever, you don't want to run it higher than what the manufacturer recommends. If you don't care, and you want to get some more oomph out of it, you know that most of the tubes are conservatively rated. You can go about another 15-20% without really having to worry about it. And I bet you on those 6146s that are running 800 volts or 850 volts, they don't glow up the tune properly. K2RIW, K2J.
Okay, now let me ask you this question. In the case of an incandescent light bulb, the life of the light bulb is a function of the voltage you apply to the filament, to the incandescent light bulb, and I think you raise it to 1 over the 12th power. In other words, a very small change in voltage on the filament of a incandescent light bulb can make a huge difference in the life of the light bulb. That's pretty well known. Now, you're recommending that in the case of a tube with a complex cathode like a 4CX250B, that if I want maximum life out of the tube, I lower the filament voltage to the point where I'm starting to lose sufficient emission for the particular service I'm using, where the power output is starting to drop. If I was a super conservative person, and I'm willing to sacrifice, let's say, 10% of the power output by lowering the filament voltage, what's the long-range effect of that? Am I changing the rate at which individual chemical constituents of that cathode oil off? Do I, 500 hours downrange, end up with a different chemistry of that cathode? Is there a disadvantage of me starving the filament voltage for a tube that's running under a rather heavy, back-bombarded UHF service? KE2EJ, if you happen to know, I know it's a crazy question. K2RIW in the second half.
KT2QIW to mobile.
QIW recognized, but we're going to go to Eric first. Go ahead, Eric.
All right. I don't know all the mechanisms. I don't know the chemistry of it, but there is some chemistry. There's also some space choice stuff about it, too, which has to do with temperature. But I will tell you this much. In studio lighting, we use lamps that, when you put 120 volts into them, they produce 3,200 degrees, actually 3,224 degrees, if they're quartz lamps. Okay, if you drop the voltage to 110, they don't put out 3,200 degrees anymore. They get a little redder. They put out about 3,120 or 3,140. If you drop it down to 100 volts, they wind up around 3,000. So you know that the amount of kinetic energy available there is totally dependent on the voltage. That's the point of the cathode in a lot of these tubes, is that there's an even emission surface. And because indirectly heated, allows for uniform emission of electrons. In terms of what the actual chemistry is that's going on, I could probably look it up, and next time we talk about it, have a good answer for you.
That's your choice, Eric. I thank you for the information. I think it's Joe, KC2QIW Mobile. You got something to add to this, Joe? I hope so. K2RIW and the TechNet. My name is Dick. You got it, Joe.
Hey, Roger. No, I'm just calling a friend of mine, Anthony, showing the hobby and whatnot, and I'm just in the mobile listening to you guys and supporting the net, and at this time I have no questions, but I was just showing my friend of mine about the amateur radio. Back to you.
Very fine, Joe, and his passenger in the automobile. This particular so-called technical net has met every Sunday night for the last 27 years, starting in 1982. It's a gathering of the clan. The guys who are interested in some of the details of ham radio operation get together and share information. We help each other make our antennas and our transmitters and our receivers work a little better and try to explain sometimes at the molecular level what's going on and how does all this stuff work. How does wireless really work? And one of the amazing things is that when it gets to that radio signal that's emitted by an antenna and it goes through free space, what really happens? Quantitatively, we know. I can tell you, you put X number of watts into an antenna here, and a mile away, I'm going to hear that many microvolts of signal out of my antenna. I mean, that we know. But what happens in between? Those photons that go from antenna A to antenna B through the hard vacuum of space, in the case of listening to the Apollo astronauts, for instance. A little bit of a mystery there. Okay, I think we've gone through the list of everyone who signed in earlier. I think we've handled all that question. Just to be double darn sure, I'm going to stand by to make sure. We're going to let the machine drop in case Kent is there from Dallas, Texas, and wants to sign in. So, to the A5VJB, if he wants it, K2RIW and TechNet, listening.
Then get back to me, Dick, K2KEY.
Roger. Looks like Kent is not there. And I guess there was an earlier comment you wanted to make, Mel, and I didn't get to you. Whoa, sorry about that. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Unfortunately, I got called away for a little while because I had to take a telephone call from somebody that I do some work for, and, you know, when you're consulting, you say a few words to these people that calms them down. So, about a meeting tomorrow. As far as amplifiers are concerned, Collins had a lot of complaints that the 3CX1500 was failing in a number of their amplifiers, and so, of course, they got on to the case of, at that time, iMac, of course, was making the tubes for them. And iMac said that if you do not heavy load the 3CX1500, it will fail prematurely. The tube will build up some kind of a, I don't know what you want to call it, some kind of deposit internally in the tube. And it was because a lot of hams thought that they could prolong the life of the amplifier by, taking it easy on it. Figuring, hey, it's rated at 1,500 watts. I'll run it at conservatively, much lower power. In other words, I will not load it as heavy. And that was the problem. That was ruining the tube. Also, the filament voltage, as far as iMac was concerned, was very critical to set the filament correctly. Dick, over.
Dick? Very fine. Now, go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, when you don't run the tube and it's rated current, you start to build up this phase charge between the cathode and the grid, and all that material starts to redeposit on the cathode, and you lose its ability to emit electrons. So that's a bad thing. By the way, lowering the filament voltage too much is a bad thing. That's why you bring it to the point where you get about 90% of what you get with it at the full voltage and raise it up a little bit until it kind of comes back up again. That's a good point to run it.
Yeah, I'll make another point.
Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, so some people started to reason, and I did the same thing. I said, I got an idea. Why don't I change the taps on the tank coil and decrease the inductance so I could increase the capacitance, and that will, you know, increase the Q. But I'll tell you something. Even that can give you a problem, because I found that with a tank circuit, with a tank circuit Q, a lower tank circuit Q, the chances are that you would begin, you know, to lose harmonic suppression. So you see, you really get caught between two different situations here. And of course, you don't want to, you know, get involved with the friendly candy company, Dick, over.
Yeah, I think FCC would like to have all of your harmonics 60 decibels suppressed from your fundamental power output. In the case of a 3CX1500 tube, which sounds like it is a triode, if you lightly load the tube but resonate it, that means that the plate voltage swing due to the RF cycle will be larger. The larger plate voltage swing in, let's say, Class C service, if that's what you were doing, or it's also true of Class A, the minimum plate voltage occurs at the instant of maximum emission of the tube. And as such, when the plate voltage goes as low as it's going to go, and you've got this cloud of electrons that were emitted by the control grid during the previous quarter of a cycle, and they don't get sucked up by the plate because the plate's now at a low voltage, they're going to turn around and go slam back into that cathode material. I'm not sure if a 3CX1500 is directly or indirectly heated, but I can see how the back bombardment of light loading might increase the cathode heating characteristic. It might run hot. And is that possibly the method of destruction that took place with light loading? That's a guess on my part.
Cathode contaminates.
Okay, so the space charge contamination and the contaminating materials that are in the space charge, where are they coming from? Is that from an outgassing of something, Eric, go ahead?
Well, I could be wrong about this, but from what I remember, it's actually the material that the grid's made out of. Because you're in a vacuum, the thermal conductivity of the electrons hitting the grid, because there's not enough draw on the other side of the grid, it never passes through. I don't remember what it is, but there's a difference in potential between the cathode and the grid prevents the electrons from passing through it, and as you were saying, they just bounce back and redeposit themselves on the cathode.
Now, this back bombardment characteristic I know is real, because in the case of a tetrode tube, heavy or light loading, always at resonance, makes a huge difference in the screen grid current. In fact, the fact that very heavy loading can give you negative screen current, to me, is a very strong indication that the screen grid is accepting a significant number of intercepted electrons. They, in turn, are creating secondary electrons that are being sucked into the plate that still has high voltage because of the heavy loading. Therefore, it is the secondary emission of a screen grid that's creating the negative current. I can't see any other mechanism by which negative screen grid current can take place. So, quite a significant amount of electrons do intercept those grids and create heating. And I guess by way of the loading and resonating, we're controlling how much heating those grids are experiencing, even if we're not overdriving the tube. Am I onto something here from your point of view, Eric? I'm going to go to Eric first and then Mel in that order. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Yeah, I can absolutely see that. I remember doing something with a 4CX 24,000 or a DB transmitter. And it was so underdriven and so, not underdriven, but we were working on a high voltage power supply. And the high voltage was something like less than half of what it was supposed to be. Now, the screen supply is independent, but usually there's a positive current flow there. The meter was actually pegged going the other way because it only reads voltage in one direction. But I think you are onto something with that, Dick. Also, I'm looking through the tube manual here, and they really go into it in this sense that, like, the plate voltage should be applied or simultaneously with the grid number 2 voltage. Otherwise, the voltage on grid 2 only, its current may be large enough to cause excessive grid 2 dissipation. What else? There was something else that I saw here. But I kind of agree with what you're saying. I think that's very real. K2RW, K2J.
M2EO, Dick. Rich recognized FML. In the case of a 4CX250B, the screen grid cannot tolerate more than 12 watts of dissipation. If you made the mistake of applying full screen voltage without plate voltage present, therefore all those electrons emitted by the cathode didn't go through the screen and go roaring onto the plate, they stick to the screen. The total heating of the screen, you exceed that 12 watts and you'll burn up that screen grid in a couple of seconds. Very delicate item. And screen voltage raised to the 3/2 power tells you the peak current that the tube can create. So if you want the tube to come alive and really start producing power output, raise the screen voltage and properly load the plate. And that tube can really sing. And because it was an external anode tube, forced air cooled, and by way of the parallel air cooling arrangement, I could force 3 times as much air through that anode as under normal circumstances without a whole lot of back pressure from a blower. There were people who took that parallel kilowatt amplifier, the so-called K2RIW amplifier, and got 2,000 watts out of it, key down, continuously. F9FT, Frank Tona, of the Tona Antenna Company, did that. I mean, here's an amplifier that was rated for 1,000 watt input maximum at input plate current and voltage, 700 watts output, and he was getting 2,000 watts output without burning up tubes. And you probably heard the story many times of, I wrote him a letter saying, hey, Frank, how the hell are you doing that? And back came 4 pages in French that when I translated it, had it translated, the answer was a lot of voltage, a lot of air, and a lot of drive. The maximum loudness technique, some people call it. Go ahead, Mel. K2EJ, K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, just get rid of the heat. Think about a 2C39 with a water jacket.
Oh, yeah. Boy, can you push that tube. You got it, Mel.
Boy, now you're dating yourself. 2C39. Anyhow, back to the 3TX 1500 series, or 8877 sometimes, that's a more popular number, I believe, now. You know, any time you're dealing with these high, new triodes, power triodes, they have certain things or idiosyncrasies. And I looked into a number of them, got a number of bulletins and things that came from IMAC at the time. And the filament, the 5-volt filament, well, they suggested, which Collins did put in there, as part of their multimeter readout, that you would look at the filament voltage. And I remember they have in there, they have a 25-ohm, 25-watt variable control in the heater circuit. And they said you watch that 5-volt AC going into that filament. That is a very big key to the life of the of a 3CX 1500. So a lot of the equipment that did come around, I understand that they never really considered the filament, you know, that critical. But it seems that there's a number of the better pieces of equipment did include that control. I know I have it also on the, besides the, on the linear amplifier, they also have on the KWS-1, they also had, also look at the filament voltage. They have a switch right on the front there, where you can switch the different filament voltage up. I think that that's an integral part, one of the more important factors, Dick, over.
A more important factor when it comes to tube life. So, what the filament voltage really is creating is the temperature of that cathode. And it's kind of obvious there's a rather ideal, narrow range of temperature you're shooting for to get the right amount of emission simultaneous with the right rate of oil off of that exotic chemistry that the cathode is made out of, thoriated cathodes and things like this. There's some pretty heavy metals that go into cathodes. Therefore, wherever tube manufacture takes place, in the old days, local contamination of the soil went along with it. I think the Amperex Tube Company, I forget what town they were in on Long Island, I believe the soil did become
Hicksville,
so the soil became significantly contaminated. Did they finally clean that up, to your knowledge, Eric?
Yeah, well, they had their plant on West John Street. There was an EPA cleanup years ago. I remember at Nassau Community College, we had a number of the custom-made test amplifiers for the various different tubes, and we even had a couple that operated up at 2 meters. They were cool devices.
And so we owe Dick. Rich recognized. So I think you're saying, Eric, they were capable of lots of watts output at frequencies like 2 meters or 432?
Yeah, they had a custom-made tube there that they had an amplifier for. Generated 2 kilowatts.
Nice number. Rich, N2EO, what's the Whitestone opinion on all this?
Okay, Dick, I wanted to echo what Mel said about the filament. A lot of these manufacturers running the 8877s, they really don't take it into account. On the AL1500, you know the story that I modified. One of the things I did, because Ameritron didn't put enough taps, either the filament is a little high or a little low. What I did was, it runs on 220 volts, I came off one side of the 110 and the neutral with a low current of 3 amp, 0 to 120 volt variac. Very small, maybe the size of a 25 watt rheostat. It's not very big. I mounted it on the back. And I bought test points out from the RF deck, so I can go in there and adjust the primary of the filament transformer until the secondary is exactly 5 volts, because I don't remember, it's either 5 or 10%, but it's a very close tolerance that IMAC has on that 5-volt filament, Dick. So that's the way I did it. Rather than use a rheostat in the high current line, I chose to use a 3-amp variac in the primary off one side of the 120, the 240 volt in the neutral. And this way I can keep the filament right where it belongs.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Rich. I think you've got Con Ed three-phase power going down your street, which is different than the phase A, phase B, and phase C, one phase at a time that goes into the private homes in where I live. In my case, the pole pick transformer takes the, we'll say, 7,800 volts, whatever the primary voltage is for distribution, and cuts it down to 240, 120. It's a center tap, secondary winding of a transformer, and I get all three wires. I get the two wires on the ends of the 240 volts, and I get the center tap, and from either side to the center, I get 120. In your case, I think you're really getting, and by the way, my two halves of my house are exactly 180 degrees out of phase. In your case, the two halves of your house, I think, are 120 degrees out of phase. Therefore, you don't get 240 and 120. You get some other
208.
All right, so he gets 208. He gets 120 and 208, and as such, I guess you're saying, until you rewired that filament circuit, you weren't getting enough filament voltage on your particular transmitter. Is that true, Rich, N2EO, K2LAW?
I'm getting 212. I'm getting close enough. I'm getting 212. Conets, I called them once. They said we're supposed to get on 110. The official voltage, when everything is running right, is 122.8. And I measured 212 with a couple of different digital voltmeters off the, either leg, the two phases. So that's been a problem. It really is a problem for me, because with that phase angle, running a capacitor into a power supply, my voltage always sags a little bit. So, yeah, what I found with the Ameritron, they have it, that tap for 208, but then they have a higher tap, and it was either too low or too high. I couldn't get it right. So when I made those extensive mods with the tube and all the other stuff that I did, you know, I sent you an email, Dick. One of the things I did was put a variac in there and test points so I could crank it right up to 5 volts. But the way I did it, I mounted the variac inside on the back with the shaft sticking out, and so it couldn't be accidentally turned. I mounted a Hammond, a small 2.5 by 2.5 inch Hammond box over the shaft. So you have to take the 4 screws out of the box to access the variac. That way it can't accidentally be moved.
And the bottom line of the way you're using the variac, are you taking the 212 that you get and boosting it to something like 240? Is that approximately what you're doing, Rich? Go ahead.
No, Dick. You see, what they're doing, they've got a... the way they're running the filament, they're coming off one side of the 120 line. One side in neutral and one hot side. So I guess it really wouldn't matter in this case. It just didn't have enough taps. I mean, you had 122.8 off neutral in one link, but it's just too coarse a set of taps. The adjustments Ameritron gives you is not good. So what I did was I took a 120-volt variac, I ran it off neutral and one link, and that goes to 110-volt filament transformer.
Understand. Sounds like a fun operation. And I know you were working on that about a year ago, and it sounds like you're happy with the way that rig is performing. I think we've answered everyone's questions, and Mel, maybe it's time you open your mailbag. Or anything else you want to discuss. KE2, here we go. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Well, let me tell you something. I have never seen so much email after last week's discussion, Dick. It just generated huge amounts of email that I can't even begin to pick through it. That there's so much controversy about last week's discussion about where the electronics industry, engineering, and whatever is going in this country. And so... I was going to say, if you want to say a few more words about it, because this is unbelievable what I have got in front of me. It is 187 emails, Dick. Over.
Oh, by far, that's a brand new record. Now, if you took those 187 emails you got over the week and you put them into individual piles, assuming that they fall into 2, 3, or 4 categories, how many of them sort of take exception to one of the things that we were saying, and that is, yes, outsourcing is taking place, but Kent brought to our attention the fact that the outsourcing you see in the New York City tri-state area, he is saying, is very different than what you get in other places of the United States. For instance, Dallas, Texas. He made it clear to us that a number of significant manufacturing organizations in the Dallas-Fort Worth area were doing a lot of outsourcing, and in the last couple of years, they're now coming back to insourcing, saving money, saving time, ending up happier. So, we're not completely going to the dogs. We're not doing outsourcing of everything. That's one thing we were saying. Another thing we were saying last week is I'm unhappy with the way we teach wireless engineering in our schools, and that can be improved. Another thing we were saying is that wireless engineering will be here to stay because mankind has fallen in love with portability of the portable pocket assistant, whatever you're going to call it. That thing in your pocket which... is
is a computer, it's a cell phone, it's a pager, it's a digital assistant, it's a memory device, it's a zillion things. It's a direction finder, not a direction finder, can't think of the name of the satellites that allow you to...
GPS.
But there it is, thank you. Global Positioning Satellite System. Good thing of it. Think of something like getting old. So, that thing in your pocket is going to do a little bit of everything. But the majority of the things it's doing, and particularly the Bluetooth that talks to the thing in your ear, it's all wireless. So, wireless is going to be here. I may be extremely unhappy with the way wireless engineering is taught in our schools, but if you love RF engineering, and you're afraid to go into it for fear that you think it's going to become a profession that's going to...
Repeater, time out.
You think it's going to be a profession that's going to cease to exist. I, for one, strongly disagree. But just because wireless engineering in major metro areas, I believe, is going to exist, it doesn't mean that in East Attleboro, Maine, you're going to be able to find an occupation, an employer, unless you're self-employed, in wireless engineering. Now, Kent is living in a smaller community in the outside of the Dallas-Fort Worth area called Grand Prairie. And he, as a RF consultant and antenna engineer, does a high percentage of his work by way of the Internet. So because of Internet, you don't have to keep going to a particular place of business that does your particular skill. If you set it up correctly, you hang the right kind of a shingle, got the right kind of a website, you can do it from almost anywhere. So these are some of the opinions that we were expressing last week. When people were taking exception and giving you zillions of emails, are they saying we are crazy? Or they are saying right on? Or they are saying a third thing? What were they saying from your point of view, Mel? K2KEY, K2LAW.
Yeah, I should say boil them down to what exactly they're saying. I got more negative, very few positive. In fact, they said the New York area especially, jobs are so hard to find. And in fact, one here, he says, I'm living without technology almost. Why? Because I refuse to buy a TV set unless I can buy an American one. I refuse to buy a stereo unless I can buy an American one. I refuse to buy a DVD player unless I can buy an American one. And so on. He goes down a whole list here of all the cost to consumer electronics that were in this that were normally available years ago from American manufacturers. And on here about microwave ovens and all. Of course, we may be doing some of the engineering, even though inch by inch, more of it is going offshore. They're turning out engineers too, and they're turning out technicians, and they're doing a lot of cutting edge technology. They used to wait for us to do this, development, and they said, well, we'll make it for you, just give us the schematics and whatnot. But they don't need us anymore in many cases. Just call here. He says, if you call Hewlett Packard and want to get any kind of technical help, guess where they are. Do you know where they are, Dick, the technical help for Hewlett Packard? Over.
I'm going to guess Bangalore, India, possibly Ireland, and occasionally Canada is where the phone gets answered and they try to answer your question. Am I close? Go ahead.
Exactly. I did once call Hewlett Packard. I spoke to a nice gentleman in India and I said, my God, I said, it must be 4 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the morning where you are because there's a difference in time from where I am. And he says, oh, that's okay. We work all night long. And in fact, one of them here said, oh, you can get jobs. You can go any of these places if you don't mind working for one quarter of what we have as minimum wage an hour in this country. You could easily hire, he says, as my company, as he people that will do many of the technical work that we were paying $1,000 and up a week to our employees, and now we can get 100 employees for the same amount of money that we paid one over.
Globalization is here to stay. That's an opinion. We have to think globally. It's been happening for not just the last 10 years, it's been happening for the last 200 years. My grandfather and grandmother ran a farm in Port Washington for a whole lot of years. And the local residents of Port Washington came to their farm to buy their produce, to cook their food, to put it on their table. That's what the residents of Port Washington area were doing. And a certain percentage of what he farmed, he would put on his truck and take it to market in either Brooklyn or Manhattan. As time went on, the food you ate, not all of it came from a local farmer. Some of it came from Florida and California. And therefore, you're not giving as much trade to the local merchant. And people objected to that. And here we are, the next step beyond that is an awful lot of the electronics we buy is not made in this country. But still, some of the design still takes place in this country. The manufacture is done somewhere else because the manufacture can be done much, much cheaper when it comes to massive reproduction. You want a particular printed circuit board with pick-and-place components put on it and wave soldered, let me drop, and you're going to buy 100,000 of them at a time, you could have that built in Southeast Asia, an extremely small percentage of the cost of the United States. That is a reality. It looks like it's anti-American. I understand that. And you can try to live a isolated life. You could try to live a life where you do nothing but buy American. That's, on the surface, I see the merit of it. But if you ran your business that way, you're going to quadruple the probability you're going to go out of business because the guy next door will outsource. He will get the nearly the same quality, and he'll get it at half or one-third the price. He can undercut you. We are a global society. That internet has drastically pushed us into globalization. In theory, I can, by way of the internet, like done what I did, let me drop. I had lots of conversations with an electronic engineer in La Salina, Chile, who works on top of a mountain for the European Space Agency, ESO, European Space Organization. Anyhow, it's a radio telescope and optical telescope facility in Chile. And the conversations I had with him, because he had this beautiful switching 12-volt, 40-ampere power supply in QSD magazine, the December 1999 and January 2000 issue. And I started a conversation with him. So by way of the internet, he and I are sending emails back and forth with seconds of delay between us. In the old days, you would put a letter on a slow boat and it would get to him in a month. Or if you spent a whole lot of money and sent it to him airmail, it got there in half a week. And here I am sending information and we're getting questions and answers back and forth in seconds. We are a global society. You can try to resist it if you want. I don't think you can. I wonder if Eric's got an opinion on that one. I mean, since the broadcast world uses a lot of hardware manufactured all kinds of places in the world, also by way of programs like Nova and Frontline or whatever, and some of those programs are on the subject of the good and bads of globalization. I think an adaptive human being in 2009 has to accept the fact that the world is continuing to change. It's changing a little bit more rapidly because of internet, and globalization is something you've got to accept. You can try to resist it if you want. I don't think you can. Let's see what Eric's going to say on this one. KE2EJ, if you're there. K2RIW.
WA2SAY.
Go right ahead, Doug.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wasn't around last week to butt in with this business, but of the things that I found interesting is about two or three weeks ago, I decided to visit my old gold mine, which is now in Belleville, and calls itself Honeywell. But one of the things I found interesting was the engineer who was basically taking my place, I guess, says that the quality control is really stinking. He's developed a whole process of evaluating dielectric content of PC boards because wherever they get them, it seems to be different every time, and it's always the dielectric content is different and all sorts of things like that. So it's not all that wonderful to be global. When I was there, we had a what you might call a QPL vendor. It wasn't called QPL, of course, because it's not military. But you could pretty much count on getting the same thing every time. And now they're apparently having a problem. So not everything is working wonderfully. Back to you, Dick. K2RIWWA2SAY.
Good point. Globalization and outsourcing may save you some money on a mass-produced product if you've got a good, robust design to begin with. If not, you're creating a sorcerer's apprentice. You can make a whole lot of defective printed circuit boards real fast. And I, for one, have done quite a bit of work with antenna manufacturer in Taiwan, Taipei, Taiwan, is a company we're using. And the good news is that they can produce to the nearest thousandth of an inch, serial number after serial number, exactly like cookie cutters, all of them the same, of a fairly complicated multi-step assembly. It's got the molded rubber and beryllium, copper, and all kinds of exotic materials all being put together just right with high tolerance. You tell them what you want, they can do it. But if you tell them to make changes in the design and, add a little bit of length to this until the standing wave ratio goes down to that number, all of a sudden you run into a language barrier problem. And so, and they're 12 hours different than us. So you got to be careful with outsourcing. It can be good. It can be at a disadvantage. But Kent is leading us to believe that certain companies and certain facilities are still doing mass production and bringing it back into the United States. But we are a global society. As communication gets better and better, the cultural differences will slightly decrease. I'll admit there's some cultures out there that are so different from us, they got an awful long way to go before we and they meet each other. I'm going to give you that one. But if you try to buy nothing but American on every single thing you eat and use, every service you use, every appliance you use and buy, and every food you eat, it is darn difficult. Not everyone's going to agree with it. Person, you have the freedom of attempting to do that if you want to. I think there's going to be some disadvantages. The electric shaver I use is made in Holland. The radio I use are made in Japan. The car I drive, I've driven American cars and I've driven Japanese cars.
Repeater, time out.
You know what the answer is on that one, and to an awful lot of Americans. A significant number of Americans are thinking they're getting more quality out of a Japanese car. And it's a factor that's making Detroit go through very tough times. If every single American decided that he would buy nothing but American automobiles, would that be enough to completely recover Detroit? A certain significant percentage of Detroit's sales are foreign. They don't sell just the United States. They got a bunch of factories in Europe selling American products to Europeans. From one point of view, the most ideal world would be if we've got a product of sufficient quality and it's got something unique enough about it. And if half of what is built in the United States is sold to foreign consumers, and if in the almost the same ratio, we buy foreign products. If the ratios were 50-50 in both directions, maybe people would be happy. Our manufacturing costs, though, in general, are high. Without globalization, it's hard to run certain kinds of companies. guess you were being accused by us expressing those opinions last week, and from a certain point of view, it sounds anti-American. Is that sort of what you were hearing in the emails, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW?
KC2QAQ with the comments on that?
Okay, Glenn first, and then over to you. Pass it over to Mel after you make your comment. Go ahead, Glenn.
I completely agree with what you're saying about the global economy, and there's a lot of benefits to it in terms of dealing with countries that are have very, very similar labor rates to the United States. Like when you're buying a car from Japan, chances are it could be produced here still by Americans. Even in Japan, the labor rates that they pay for their employees are very similar to the United States, and the same thing with Europe. And as long as we're trading with countries that have very, very similar labor rates, globalization could be a beautiful thing. But the downside and the greed that has really socked the world economy to the point that, you know, billions of dollars have to be pumped into the Fed is because there's greed in trading with countries that have labor rates less than one-tenth of what the United States is. So when you take jobs that the middle class has and shift them to nations that are paying one-tenth to ship things over there, we're going to feel it, and it's going to hurt for quite some time unless somebody puts some regulations in between to say, whoa, you can't just throw everything over the border here that quick. You know, you have to do it slowly and wait till labor rates kind of like equalize out. But if we're just going to throw a lot of high-tech and good-paying jobs to countries that have labor rates much, much out of whack from ours, we're going to feel it somewhere, Dick. K2RAW, KC2QIQ, just an opinion.
I hear you. Glenn, if your name was Barack Obama, assuming you had the ability to control the situation that you're describing, if you were the president, and if you had the control, and if Congress would back you, what would you do to correct it?
Well, see, I happen to believe that this is just a... I don't believe that the politicians can do anything about it. I mean, they're reacting to something that has already happened the best way that they can. It wouldn't matter whether it was a Republican, a Democrat, or whatever. Once companies realize, whoa, we can, you know, build things in China and in India, they're going to do it because they can. The government, they're going to be so far behind the eight ball trying to react to it, there's nothing that they can do. Unfortunately, what will happen is it will eventually level out. Either, you know, the economy is going to go out of whack, we'll throw trillions of dollars at it, and eventually it'll straighten itself out, but it doesn't mean it's not going to be painful in the meantime. And as I said, I don't think that this is something... Economies aren't run by politicians. You can try to control it, you can try to put in certain things, but eventually those controls just get worked around, and we just have to bear through this one and hope for the best.
I hear you. Mel, if you had the power to change it, what would you do? I know this is not an easy one. First of all, there's two questions here. What would you do to make the American economy better? That's a tough one. And what would you do to keep the people who send you emails happier? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, no, I have the answer. This is K2KEY. In fact, I did write to the president, and I think I gave him a fairly good answer. You're taking all this money, billions and billions of dollars, you're giving it to banks. The banks are not loaning the money out. They're holding on to it. They're hoarding the money. The only way you're going to get this, you've got to give this economy a so-called kick in you know where. We've got to stimulate. And the only way to do it is at the grassroots. The people that do purchasing, the average Joe in the street. And I said, here's what you do. You give every tax-paying citizen in this country a voucher for $1,000 that they have to spend within 3 months. They cannot use the money, the cash, you cannot cash it in. They can buy clothing, they can buy household goods, appliances, anything they would like to buy. And here is the money, spend it. You'd get the retail business, give it a good start, get that retail business moving again. That means people would be hired to work in these, in the retail industry. Truckers would be moving stuff to resupply the shelves et cetera, et cetera. But giving the money to, I can say, the banks right now, you can't get a loan. They're not going to loan it out. Now they've gone the opposite direction of handing it out first for anyone that came in and signed their name. Now you, they check your blood type, literally. That's step number one. Number two, if you see what they're doing in, right now in Germany, they decided to give people a very nice chunk of a discount on cars. If you owned, I think, a car more than 10 years, in other words, if the registration of the car was more than at least 10 years or more in your name, they will give you, in Germany, somewhere around, I think, $3,600 or $4,000 towards the purchase of a new car. Their dealerships are busy there. People with clunkers, you know, 10 years old or more, all of a sudden have a car that was ready, literally just junk, worth it for junk, but was still creeping along. All of a sudden, they could go in and get themselves a new car with a $4,000 credit from their old clunker. Hey, why not do it here? Maybe the worst, but the stipulation I would put, it has to be, you have to buy from one of the three American manufacturers of automobiles. I know they get their parts from many places. You know, there's not a, you know, situation like Ford used to claim back in the Model T Ford days, that raw materials come in one side of the factory and an automobile drives out the other side, that they made everything right up, even including the glass, the tires, the rubber and everything. I mean, those days are gone. But if you want to keep these, let me let it drop. If you want to keep these American manufacturers such as General Motors and Chrysler and Ford alive, I know they're on somewhat of an antique company, some cases like they did 50 years ago, which of course you cannot do like you say today. But if you want to keep them going, just giving them money, you know, is not the answer. You're going to have to, again, get people to buy their products. I mean, other than that, what are they going to do? Make cars that nobody's going to buy, and what are you going to do with them? In fact, right now, they have a backlog. They got stuff from 2008. They got 2009s, and now you got the 2010s coming along. What are they going to do with all these cars, Dick? Over.
Get you well.
I turned off the tone by mistake. I think I heard Kempton there. W5EJB, did I hear you? Looks like I didn't. Thought I did. There was another person who signed in. I think I heard him on the input, but maybe not on the output. Want to try again? I heard something that sounded like ALX, and maybe you don't have your PL turned to 136.5. I'm hearing you on the input, but I'm not hearing you on the output. Want to try again? Or try turning on your PL? I heard you say you're on your PL now, but you're not coming through the machine, even though I'm hearing you on the input. Okay. That person is going to have to make a change with their system to get through the machine. The point about, even if you buy an American car, a certain percentage of the parts are foreign-made, the subassemblies. And even if you buy a foreign car, a certain amount of it is assembled in the United States. So, what is an American car and what is a foreign car is not so clear. This is a global society. And, once again, we've got to adapt. Times are changing. I know it's not easy. Those are great words that I can say and they roll off the tongue, but if I was standing in Detroit right now, a high percentage of those people out of work would say, what in the world are you telling me to do? That doesn't do it. And I don't know how you solve that one. By the way, you believe that if each person is given $1,000 to spend in the next 3 months, the economy will get a kick. The people who are on Social Security, I think they've just been told they're going to be given $600, each person on Social Security, beyond a certain salary level of Social Security. I think they're all going to get $600 if they haven't already gotten it. Maybe I read that particular report incorrectly. And you can correct me on that one, Mel, because I think you might be on Social Security, and therefore
Maybe they told you you're going to get a $600 check. There was another point I was going to make there, but I've forgotten it. Oh, well. Back to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Kent's not logged in.
Oh, that was Kent? Oh, he's not